Hello, my name's Russell Trafford-Jones and welcome to Broadcast Focus, the channel where we talk to the people behind the media industry, finding out what drives the passion behind their work. Now, surprisingly, rather than talking about production or technology so far on the channel, we've covered a lot of topics about the industry, meta topics, you might say, and it's hard to say the word meta without either Bruce Devlin or Mark Zuckerberg turning up. And today, it's Mr. MXF himself, Bruce Devlin, who's joining me to work out whether AI has come to save our industry's metadata-starved workflows, and if so, not a second too soon. Bruce, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Russell. Real pleasure to be here.
Good stuff. I'm glad to see you. I think it's going to be an interesting chat today because we're bringing together two things that have been going on for a long time. I think AI has been created since the 80s and metadata has always been around. What would you say, as someone who's worked with metadata for a long time, how would you kind of sum up what that whole thing is?
Well, it's interesting. Not only have I worked with metadata for a very long time, I've also worked with AI since I was at university back in the 1980s. But AI is a very different thing now. And one of the things that's really changed is AI is nowadays very much a let's correlate data about data about data about data all the way around the world and have 7 billion data points. So that if I get some chat engine to predict the next word in this sentence, it will look at all the words I've just said, look at all the words that have ever been said and say, think the next word he's likely to say is spatula, or whatever random hallucination the current AI is going to come up with. So one thing that really interests me is the fact that we've got to the point where by correlating everything that's out there, we can guess the next word of a person, or we can guess how many fingers have to go on this hand that you're painting, or guess what the face should look like if it was on this sort of body. But interestingly, the human brain is quite good at remembering a lot of this stuff. And actually, specifically for media, little things like guessing who's in front of the camera. Well, you know what? The accountant knew who was in front of the camera when we did the production. And if the recording from the accountancy department is better than the recording from the engineering department who forgot was in front of the camera, so we had to use AI to go and re-remember, there's probably something wrong with the way that we're doing things. So I have both passion about metadata and also passion about, well, let's remember stuff that's dumb to forget and use the AI for really good things.
So it's an interesting idea, I think, for many people to think about how uniting both ends of the production chain, really. It's like literally right at the beginning and somehow bringing that info through. And I've certainly heard other thoughts about, you know, if the props department knows exactly what they've bought and put on a table, then clearly you can use that information. You don't have to work out whether it's a Rolex or whatever. And if you're going to start building that kind of information into a channel or a film or something like that, then that can be done in the right way. It can be done well and interesting. And I think it's always a good point to not try and use the same new technology to do absolutely everything. But it crossed my mind the other day that in the same way as when we put stuff away, whether it's in a cupboard and a wardrobe or whatever, we just unconsciously we put things away and we've seen it and we kind of know what it is anyway. So if anyone says, have you got any, you know, yellow clothes or you've got anything that's blue in there, you just know, oh yeah, it's got that. Or have you got anything that might be good for this, you know, oh yeah, go in my drawer because I'm sure there's something there. I seem to remember that. You might not remember what it's called, but you remember you got a thingamajig and you know that information is there, and it's something which has been missing all these years in files. We've been trying our best to write down what's in a file, and when we stick it with another 100,000 assets in the media asset management system, it's hard to drag out all of that. And so I guess we've got this opportunity, perhaps for the first time, where everything that we put away in our media asset management cupboard will actually have all of that knowledge, and we can just say, oh, have you got something which is just perfect for this situation? Are we at that stage? I know there's plenty of other uses of the kind of new generative AI that's become so popular, but is that practical? Is that a nice direction for us to be going in?
Yeah, it's kind of practical. On the plus side, the hope that it will work is great. But when you think a little harder about it, let's take the sort of the yellowish use case. What does yellowish mean in English? And is it the same thing in German? Is gelbisch the same as yellowish? And what about French? What about Chinese? Chinese doesn't have a direct correspondence for yellow. It's got kind of, you know, dirt color and light dirt and dark dirt. So as you start to put stuff away in the cupboard, does the person in China who made the series that you're watching describe yellow the same way that the distributor who's in America wants to distribute the content? And does the consumer in Germany who's going to watch the Chinese program distributed by the American company into Germany, is their understanding of yellowish the same as your understanding of yellowish? Now, there's, you know, the old-fashioned way of doing this, if you want to take the sort of the 1960s sledgehammer, is let's all standardize how we speak. Let's have an Esperanto for the sorts of metadata we use to describe programs. And there have been many, many, many attempts to do this. And I have to say, unfortunately, I am guilty of trying to do that back in the early days of MXF. Even though I thought it was impossible, I bowed to my elders and betters that this was a thing that was worthwhile. And of course, it failed terribly. And one of the really interesting little experiments that was done at the Institute for Rundfunktechnik in Munich. A number of German public service broadcasters, all independent, were put in a room. They were given 300 metadata properties from a dictionary. So there's only 300 they're allowed. And they had to choose what they thought were the most important properties to describe their content in their MAMS. And the really good thing is that everybody chose about 10 different properties. But nobody chose the same ones. And that's quite amazing, because if you're outside Germany, most people who aren't native German speakers can't tell the difference between Bayerischer Rundfunk and Südwestrundfunk. They're just two German-speaking public service broadcasters. Mm. But if you're in Germany and you're in the Südwestrundfunk area, there's a huge difference between these two organizations. And one of the things that we figured out was that actually the metadata is acting as a proxy for the value you think that is in that program. And of course, if my business is different to your business, Russell, then I will have different important metadata to the important metadata that you're going to put in. Mm. So how do you fix that? And the answer is it's not easy, but the one way you can never fix it is by standardizing on the metadata. So in a way, AI is wonderful, because AI says, well, yellow and gelb, they're about the same name for a color in two different languages. So if I look for synonyms or, you know, close related terms in my 7 billion terms, I might do a better job than any human could ever do trying to find, you know, trying to match your yellow stylish shoes with my yellow stylish trousers, for example. That might actually work. Go AI.
So I think we've got to separate these ideas where there's a practical element to, if I've made a program, some form of a media set, and I'm going to pass that on to you, then what you're interested in is how can I provide you with some metadata that describes that? Because I think if we put our generative AI hat on, we just think that there's this monolithic AI which knows what it is. So you could then just ask the AI. But of course, that doesn't work when you're passing programs between companies, unless there's like one broadcast and film industry AI, which knows everything about everything, which is, so, but, you know, apart from instituting that, we can use the AI to create this metadata. But then that problem is, well, okay, great. I've got, as you say, that's 300, 3000 different words. How do I make that useful to you? Is that kind of the elements at play?
Yeah, absolutely. And AI is very good at finding similes for stuff, but isn't very good at having very precise meanings. Whereas the people that created the metadata in the first place, so, you know, the person that designed the schema for brand X's MAM system, when they talked about, let's take a word that everybody sort of understands, the word duration. What's the duration of that program? Well, that's actually quite precise when they designed their MAM system, assuming they'd thought of all the corner cases for the word duration, because when we put the word duration into MXF, for example, there's about four different durations to describe any clip, depending on whether you're an engineer, whether you're the program producer, whether you're the person doing the pre-roll to get it to sync up with your SCTI 35 advert inserts and all the other things that duration is really important for you. And so it's that there's varying levels of specificity you need in your metadata depending on the applications. And actually it's something that it's a problem, and I'm going to sort of take a little left turn here to talk about how we make metadata today. So typically, if somebody wants to add metadata to a program and then give it to somebody else, the first thing they'll do is, right, there's got to be a solution for this already out there. And they'll do a quick Google search on program metadata, and they might land on the Movie Labs website or a SMPTE website, one of the hundreds of papers I've written on the subject over the years. And they might go, oh, well, that's close enough, I'll use that. And then they start to implement, and then they go, oh, well, it's not quite right. I know, I'll just tweak it a bit for my own purposes. And then once that tweaking happens, you discover 1 year down the line that actually it looks nothing like the original, and you've now got yet another version of that specific metadata out there. And if for anybody who's an enthusiast of XKCD, I recommend XKCD/960, which explains this problem better than I can in four panels. So we're kind of doomed, if we always use that approach, we're kind of doomed to repeat the process over and over again. And I had this idea a very long time ago that what if the metadata could describe itself? So it didn't matter whether I had one canonical term for yellow, or it was just sort of yellowish, or you know, slightly off mud color. You know, if I didn't care about that, I could specify in my metadata that the color was informative rather than imperative. Imperative meaning, of course, that I was going to use that metadata to take some sort of irreversible action on the metadata. Mm-hmm. Sorry, on the content itself. And I reverse back to what I said earlier, that the metadata is really just a proxy for the thing. And if I unwind all of those words and put them into some sense, imagine that you were going to buy a pair of shoes. It's nice to have a description of them. It's nice to have a photograph of them, but you don't really know whether those shoes are going to fit you and look right until you put them on your feet.
Yeah.
So if you have in front of you the options of a beautiful textual description written by a Pulitzer Prize winning author, or a photograph taken by a famous photographer, or the actual shoes, you will always pick up the shoes first if you're actually going to spend your money and choose them.
Yeah.
However, if the shoes, let's call it a movie, is 4 terabytes and you live in the English countryside like you and I do, you know that you're not getting the stuff for about 6 weeks of downloading. It's actually cheaper to fly over, get the USB drive and then fly back again. It's cheaper and faster to do that than try downloading it. So the metadata really is just a proxy for the stuff until you can get the stuff. And if there's a field in that metadata that's going to cause you to do something irreversible, like spend money, cue it for play on Netflix, translate it into French, that metadata had better be right. But if you're just describing that, Russell's shirt was not quite pure white, but it's slightly off-white to give that nice sort of creamy texture to make his rosy cheeks shine on the webcast, you know, that's not an imperative bit of metadata. But it is useful to have because, you know, sometime in the future you might be searching for Russell Trafford Jones wearing white shirt, and this would be an appropriate clip that you'd find. So those usages are really important, and knowing why the metadata is there and what you intend people to do with it might help you in this metadata chaos problem that we have.
I see. So it's the same as when you're trying to fill out a form. And, you know, it's making you select one thing or another and say, well, that's not it. In this situation, you're able to, it says, I'd like to know your address. And you fill out, you know, you create your own form, basically. You're mm-hmm. adding in this information saying this is important. This is somewhere near London, and you can give it that flavor. And is the aim then that you've got that flexibility to put in as much or as little as is practical for your operation?
I wouldn't use the phrase practical. Mm-hmm. I say as much or as little as you care to do.
Okay.
Because at the end of the day, it costs effort to put metadata into a system, and it costs effort to take the metadata out and look at the metadata. And ideally, what you're trying to do is minimize effort and maximize value in any of these systems, whether it's a MAM, whether it's a lookup system, whether it's an indexing system. The more effort you put in, the more useful you hope it's going to be. So I'll take a very, very simple example. And this is really what inspired the whole Project MetaRex project that we showed at IBC. Imagine that you wanted to send me your favorite pair of yellow shoes. I keep choosing yellow. I'm sure you do have yellow shoes. I mean, who hasn't? You basically pick up the phone and, you know, phone FedEx or UPS or the Royal Mail or someone like that. Mm-hmm. They'd rock up with a box. They'd put the shoes in a box. You'd type your type my address into a form.
Yep.
You type your address into the form. And then a single barcode would go on the box and the box would vanish. And sometime later, it would arrive at my house. Mm-hmm. Now, that's actually an incredibly complex thing that's happening behind the scenes. It might be going via a van to a warehouse. The warehouse then goes into an automatic sorting place. The automatic sorting place puts it on another big dispatch van or a plane or a train, depending on where it's got to get to. It might end up in another sorting house, get automatically sorted again, driven to a local depot where it then goes into a smaller van or a bicycle, then ends up being effectively delivered to my house, mm-hmm. all via one barcode. Now, if the Royal Mail and FedEx and others can do that for something as widely varied as a USB drive to a pair of shoes to a puppy dog, why is the broadcast industry so rubbish at moving a small JSON file from A to B and understanding what it is when it gets to the far side? So spookily, this is one of the things that we actually demonstrated in one of the very first MXF demonstrations back in 1998 in the basement of Television Centre at the BBC, where we had an experimental camera from Philips Pleda, as they were at the time, now Grass Valley. They'd replaced the cassette mechanism with a hard disk that was designed by a company that made black box recorders for airplanes, so you could drop it and it still worked.
Nice.
We had one group writing experimental MXF code. They became MOG Solutions. We had another group making experimental MXF code. They became OpenCube, bought by EVS. Mm-hmm. And we had another group writing experimental MXF code, and that ended up at freemxf.org. And so when I say to people, I'm so sorry, MXF probably was my fault. It probably really was, unfortunately, because those three different code versions did the transfer, or basically MXF, we considered a box into which you put video and audio and metadata. And so we put the video, audio, and metadata from the camera onto the hard drive. We pulled it out during the mid-demo, and we plugged it into a modified version of Avid, I think it was Media Composer back then, or whatever it was, Avid's editor of the day in 98.
Yep.
And the content was viewed live on the timeline. So as soon as we plugged the disk in, the data was available, and we could edit it, we could scrub it, we could go backwards and forwards, and we could show metadata from the camera on the timeline. From that point onwards, all the way through to the present day, the video pipe and the audio pipe for MXF have got better and better and better, so that now, you know, every digital cinema you go to anywhere on the planet, it's basically you're watching an MXF file. Probably 70% of shoots have MXF in the pipeline somewhere, possibly exclusively MXF in quite a lot of those pipelines. But the metadata carriage, the dream that, you know, the golden thing that was going to make it all work, we'll just leave the metadata on the floor along with all the other outtakes. And that, I felt, was kind of unfinished business. So, and I should probably do something about that and generate more people that hate me in the industry.
It feels to me like it's, I mean, not everything is an opportunity for monetization. But so I'm not saying that, but it does feel like there's a missed opportunity. You know, the fact that people are happy to leave the metadata on the cutting room floor means that they're not benefiting from it, and they don't see, you know, what they need. So sure, people are dragging through what they need to, but it pretty much is a drag through. Whereas if there was a lot more presented and available in general, then, you know, you'd think, oh, well, I can rely on this, so I'll do this and I'll do that. And, you know, I think although you can have too much, as in, as you say, the opportunity cost, the financial cost, the effort of creating this is, you know, can be a lot. You've got to get that balance. But it does seem like, yeah, we're used to basically having no metadata apart from FileMate. And okay, that's a bit unfair. But, you know, we're used to just having the bare bones. And if only there was something, you know, we should be able to do something more interesting, basically, if we just had more metadata.
And the problem is that the problem is so vast. There's so much metadata. There's more new sorts of metadata being generated each year than there was in the previous 5 years. No, it's the problem's not going away. And to standardize it or harmonize it is such a huge problem that it's kind of daunting to anyone apart from people with the biggest egos on the planet. To think that, you know, this thing's even solvable. But just like the old joke, you know, what's the best way to eat an elephant? You know, one bite at a time. I think we can do this with the metadata problem as well, because, just a little bit of rewind. I spent years and years and years building audio video transcoders. So basically trying to get somebody's production spec to meet somebody else's delivery spec. And trying to get them to agree was never going to happen. So by a curious arrangement of pricing of the kit, pricing of the codecs, and quality that you could get going from a certain production spec to a certain delivery spec, what we discovered is that the more variety, the more channels you had to deliver to with the more varying delivery specs, the more expensive you would have to make it, the transcoding operation, to get to those exotic delivery specs. And so over time, those exotic delivery specs started to vanish. And I think the same is true with metadata, because the metadata cost isn't really the bandwidth of moving stuff around. It's the engineering cost of taking somebody's private metadata format and integrating it into your generic MAM or your specific camera system or your specific storage system. And if we could just take that engineering cost out and have it sort of automatically work, then I think you've saved enough money over enough projects that suddenly it starts to become worthwhile, particularly if you're a MAM or you're a production microservices vendor or you're an integration manager or you're trying to get stuff into a generic database. So this concept that you have in the database world of ELT, which is extract, transform, and then load, or extract, load, and transform, depending on what you're trying to do. That concept, if we can turn that into a streaming media metadata concept, then I think we're starting to get to a point where building generic connectors between systems really will work in our industry. And that's really what I'm working on at the moment.
You mentioned a project at IBC. So if I bring that up, then it might be worth us just having a quick look at that, because this is part of the IBC Accelerator program from IBC last year. So take us through what you demoed.
So the little video playing at the top left-hand corner was basically a showreel where we marked up various different sorts of content, and then we provided a user with what is their choice for what they wanted to watch, say, in a nature documentary. So we had AIs marking up content, we had humans marking up content, and each of the outputs of those systems, although accurate, was in a completely different data format. Some were in XML, some were in JSON, some were tagged by content and then time, some were tagged by time and then content. So basically, there's a structural problem of getting all of these into one system. And so the MetaRex project that I'm running basically said, well, this is a perfect way to show that if the metadata could describe itself, we can build automatically a normalization engine. So the MetaRex team sat down and we designed the schemas that allowed each one of these representations to be described by itself. And we made the schemas quite rich. Then we built a little engine that understood the schemas and it started to match terms. So things that were time, we could match against other things that were time, even if the units were different, because they'd matched the same thing, we could do some inference and we could also just plain old work out what the units were from each of the schemas. Bottom line was we normalized all of the metadata from all of these different sources using a semi-automatic tool. And by using the MetaRex methodology, we did all of that in about a week. But once we built it once, you can now use that forever. And the incremental cost of adding yet another metadata source into the system is now virtually zero, because we've got the basic transform engine. And so when I talk about self-describing metadata, this is really what I mean. And what we demonstrated was that if you wanted to watch Big Buck Bunny, for example, without the bunny, we put a switch on there so you can watch Big Buck Bunny and you can turn the bunny off. And it turned into a movie about teenage rodents killing and torturing butterflies, which is much more insidious and absolutely hilarious. So I'm not sure if the website demo is working at the moment. I might have to go and reboot it and get it working again. But we're trying to keep the website demo up. So if people watching this want to go and play with the demo, just click on the buttons and hopefully you'll be able to see Big Buck Bunny without the bunny.
Sounds good. Yes. You can make things very short if you exclude lots of things. But yes. But it does remind me, I can't remember who said it the other day, but it resonated with me that they wanted to watch some highlights of some football the day afterwards. And yep. I know there's all sorts of rights issues with football and things, but the point is that they were able to find a 2-minute highlights reel, but they weren't able to, that didn't really, they had a quarter of an hour to sit down and watch it.
Yeah.
But there wasn't this ability to get a flavor for the match, because you don't get a flavor with just the 2-minute highlights. You just, yeah. Oh yeah, that's what happened. Great. I can be part of conversations again. So it's a shame to miss out on that. But of course, some people only have 7 minutes. So I think with this, you can't build that kind of responsive highlights package unless both the program itself has been tagged, and I guess that's where at least some automation comes in, whether it's machine learning or whatever it is. And then you've got to have that ability to, across multiple production houses, etc., bring that metadata in. And if it's on iPlayer or whatever, then have that front end that can control it.
And that's a really good point. And that's effectively the bit that got most people excited of this demo, is that we had 10 levels of narrative importance, sort of, 0, 10, all the way up to 100. So 100 is must show. And 0 was, Chris Packham talking about penguin poo, which some people might enjoy it, but not everybody does. And as we went through tagging things with, this is a dog, this is a cat, this is a, this is a baby fox eating a bird live on air. So that was tagged with like 80% narrative importance, but also tagged with predation and killing stuff, so that somebody who didn't want to watch predation and baby birds being killed but only had 15 minutes to spare, they would turn the sort of the duration knob up and down, or the importance knob up and down, until the duration of the program threw away all the less narrative important bits and ended up at the time that they wanted. So your dream of saying, I've got 15 minutes before I've got to go and pick up the kids from school, can I watch the entire 4-hour Tour de France? Yes, you can. And just get the bits deemed to be narratively important by, the AI or Ned Bolting, whoever it was that did the tagging for you.
Yeah, so it's an interesting balance then, hadn't fully appreciated before, where we've got the ability to add in and describe everything with AI or people, but it's not going to do a lot when we've got that amount of metadata. It's not going to do very much unless we're able to freely distribute the metadata and do it well at the same time.
Yeah, and interchange it in a way that people can understand it. And to my sort of description of the shoebox with the barcode on it, that's really all my project MetaRex is. It's a box, which happens to be an MXF container, which adds a few hundred bytes to anything you're trying to send around. And the barcode on it, it's really just saying, inside this box, inside this box, you will find some metadata. So I've got this little workflow diagram at the top, which says, up at the top, you've got a sender who's trying to send something. So they put it into our MetaRex box. And then the sender effectively puts a barcode on it, which says, here's the identification of the manifest or the class ID of the stuff that's in the box. That happens in the wrapping process. Then you want to map the box onto whatever distribution network you're using. So now, you know, if you've got 1,000 different sorts of metadata, you need 1,000 protocols to get it onto NDI, ST2110, WebRTC, and all the other things. But if you're in the MetaRex box, you only need one mapping to 2110. We'll write an FMX ST2110 part 41 MetaRex mapper, and that's it. Once you put it in the MetaRex box, from that point onwards, the rest of the system knows how to move it around, just like FedEx knows how to move your yellow shoes on whatever means of transport it needs to get to me. And that's really important if you've got a mixed mode network where you might have, you know, a small local studio running NDI, but that's got to feed into the big ST2110 studio, which crosses your country's backbone in order to get back down to a WebRTC studio in some university somewhere. If you've got the stuff in a container, actually, you only have to map the container between all of these different networks, and you don't have to map 1,000 different protocols, and the metadata doesn't fall off anymore. And unpacking it, well, scan the barcode, you know what's in it, and you can either reject it because it's of no use to you, or you can choose to open it. And the really key thing is, if you know what's in the box, you might know in advance whether or not you can handle it. And if I could be so bold as to ask you to scroll to the top of the page and just hit the reg button right at the top, UE/reg, there we go. So what the barcode does, just like FedEx or anybody else, is it resolves to a database entry. And the database is online because everything about MetaRex is public and open domain. You can download the source code, you can play with it, you can download the source code to the website if you like it. But the MetaRex ID, and I'll ask you to click on the left-hand side, it says MRX123456789ABC, the top one. So that is the specification of the actual MetaRex register entry. And one of the things that we can do there is we can publish web services. So for example, imagine that you've built a web service workflow engine. One of the ones I kind of like is made by a company called Qibb, Q-I-B-B. And they're able to import a thing called an open API definition of a web service, and suddenly it becomes automatically available as a node to which you can connect stuff. So MetaRex can define web services as an open API document. So if you say, I've got a service that converts yellow shoes into blue shoes, then you can publish that in the MetaRex service area. And not only do you now control your metadata, but you can make secondary revenue maybe off your service that you wrote to convert your yellow metadata into blue metadata. And by publishing that as open API, anybody with a workflow engine should be able to import that and then publish that service, and people then can then use it. Mm-hmm. It can be free. You might want to charge for it. That's not my problem. My problem is just to make certain the barcode is useful to the industry and we're doing less engineering but getting more value.
Cool. That's really interesting. So what's the availability and the status of all of this work?
Well, we have a GitHub repo, and there's a link on the front page, and we've got our first phase of demo software, which we use to build everything at IBC. So all of that IBC demo, the source code for all of that is available. It's a little bit engineering in, a bit low level, because it was done in a rush, because all IBC accelerators are like that.
That's where it works.
But the thing we're building now, which I think will be genuinely useful, particularly to people who are putting product workflows together, is an automatic connector generator. So if I randomly pick two names of database, let's pick Airbyte and Snowflake, for example. You know, these are database management platforms, or sorry, data management platforms, more than just databases. But they both have the concept of being able to build a connector. So we had a bit of a head scratch over some adult beverages over the Christmas period, and reckoned if we could use MetaRex to automatically build an Airbyte connector, or automatically build a Snowflake connector, because you knew that the source was, I don't know, lens metadata from an ARRI lens, but the target that you wanted to put into the data was the new SMPTE RIS OSVP standardized lens metadata. If you wanted to do that transfer automatically, well, actually, that's just the straight mapping problem to do. And we've already got the technology to do that automatically. So if we could do between 70 and 90% of the work to make that connector perfect for you just by clicking on a button, suddenly we've taken away weeks, if not months worth of work to try and get your metadata from where you've got it to where you need it. And the people who care are typically the people at the edges, not the people in the middle. So the people at the edges who care now get well over half their work done for them for free. And in many cases, the work will be done automatically, and it will just be there. And some nerds will want to build these sorts of adapters and just register them in the Metrics database as a service that they could make some money off by converting between common source formats and common destination formats that require just a little bit of secret sauce or something like that. And I'm just giving all the software for free. So I'm just trying to get a few backers to help me put bread on the table so I can finish this thing and actually get it out there. But I've got no intention to charge for any of this stuff. People want the source code, just take it. Enjoy.
Cool. That's really good. Metrics.media. But you can just search for Metrics and that'll come up. All to do with dinosaurs, yes. That's good. Really interesting, Bruce. Thanks for joining me and delving in to a bit of AI and the metadata. I think it's a lot clearer to me now. So thanks for that. I saw a YouTube video this morning where the guy at the end said, subscribe if you like. And whilst I applaud his laissez-faire attitude to subscriptions, for such a small channel, I'm taking a hard line and saying it has to be done. So please make that a consideration, and I'm sure you'll agree with me that it was great to have Bruce here. So thank you very much, Bruce. Cheers.
Thank you, Russell.